Well, as it's described in our Fox News editorial, this announcement, Mr. Secretary, drives a dagger into the heart of the climate change religion.
Oh, the climate change religion. I got to get to church.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Or climate synagogue.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Climate mosque.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
I don't know.
Get down the stairs.
It's Fox News.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I thought they fought for religious freedom. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. All right, we got a guest joining us momentarily that I am very eager to speak with, speaking of the climate change religion and Fox News. I guess you can, Rush Limbaugh, well, I guess he'll never really die, will he?
No, sadly, his legacy will continue to live with us for many, many, many years.
Sadly, indeed. Hey, Desi Doyen.
Hey.
In any event, we got a guest joining us momentarily, a man who has been fighting for the climate for decades now, from non-governmental organizations in the early days of the creation of the EPA to having a hand in writing the International Montreal Protocol that, through collective global action, successfully stopped depletion of the planet's critical ozone layer? Huh. When we work together, we actually can make changes to the entire planet. Go figure. Up through roles in the EPA itself during the Clinton administration, and now back at the forefront of facing down the threat posed by, well, the Trump administration via a huge new announcement this week as it attempts to dismantle climate change regulations in one fell swoop on behalf of their benefactors in the fossil fuel industry. Longtime climate and energy expert and attorney David Doniger of the Natural Resources Defense Council will join us momentarily on that. But, it was not long after we got off air from yesterday's broadcast, Des, that a major 8.8 magnitude earthquake slammed a region in eastern Russia.
The Kamchatka Peninsula, yes.
Lighting up tsunami watches and alerts and warnings across pretty much half the globe. After what was recorded as, I think, the sixth largest earthquake in modern history. And warnings went out from Russia to Japan to Hawaii to Alaska to the Pacific coast of the continental U.S., from Washington State and Oregon down here to Southern California, all the way down to the coasts of Central and even South America. And I got to say, for some of us with still fresh memories of watching that tsunami back in 2011 live as it rolled in following a 9.1 quake in Japan, watching it roll into Fukushima, Japan, killing about 22,000 people, causing a meltdown to a nuclear power facility. It was a bit alarming on Tuesday, even here in Los Angeles, where the tsunami waves were predicted to hit overnight and into the morning. All of that said, Des, as we go to air, I believe most of the alerts have now been downgraded. Was there any substantive damage from that tsunami?
Surprisingly, no. So far as I can tell, there has been no reports of deaths or even major damage pretty much anywhere. There were lots of evacuations in Japan, in Russia, in Chile, mm-hmm. in other areas, but
it was
no
damage.
The
memory was fresh for them, too,
The
2011 tsunami.
Most definitely.
There were 4-foot, 4 or 5-foot waves that hit parts of Hawaii?
Well, it does. So the Hawaiian Islands were definitely braced for the most severe impact, but they did experience the largest tsunami wave heights around the world, it appears, from that earthquake. They saw wave heights in some areas reaching as much as 5.7 feet, which is a lot. But again, no damage was reported to state highways. All the airports have resumed operation.
Good.
In Northern California, near the border with Oregon, low-lying Crescent City saw tsunami wave heights of 3.6 feet. That was the highest recorded in California. And then there's continuing alerts around the world as this tsunami makes its way across the planet. Chile is still under an advisory. Alerts are underway in Colombia, Ecuador, the Galapagos Islands, New Zealand, etc. But right now, National Weather Service officials are urging people in affected areas to stay cautious over the next 24 hours because the ocean remains pretty disrupted.
Unsettled.
And the waves are stubbornly persistent.
Well, happy to see that the global warning system, I almost said global warming system, but the global warning system for this seems to have worked, and that people seem to have followed it and gotten the hell out of the way. So that is some comforting news today. A bit of politics before we get to my guest today. A former Vice President Kamala Harris will not run for California governor next year. She announced on Wednesday, leaving open the possibility that she could mount another run for the White House in 2028. Why not? Trump lost in 2020. He came back to win in 2024. I'm not saying she should. I'm just saying she could. And why not, after considering running for the chief office in California and deciding against it? Quote, "Over the past 6 months, I have spent time reflecting on this moment in our nation's history and the best way for me to continue fighting for the American people and advancing the values and ideals I hold dear," Harris said in a statement on Wednesday. "I have given serious thought to asking the people of California for the privilege to serve as their governor. I love this state, its people, and its promise. It is my home. But after deep reflection," she said, "I've decided that I will not run for governor in this election," she said. She has reportedly spent months deciding whether or not to run for governor here in California or to stage another run for the White House or step away from electoral politics altogether after her bruising defeat by Trump last year, after she had taken up the mantle late in the electoral cycle just months before Election Day, following Joe Biden being pressured to drop out after his disastrous debate performance against Trump in the last year's one and only presidential debate. You'll remember that Trump refused to debate Kamala Harris for some reason. Harris did not mention Trump directly in her statement, but she said, quote, "Our politics, our government, and our institutions have too often failed the American people, culminating in this moment of crisis. For now," she said, "my leadership and public service will not be in elected office." That's for now. She said, "I look forward to getting back out and listening to the American people, helping elect Democrats across the nation who will fight fearlessly, and sharing more details in the months ahead about my own plans." Oh, she's running. In the United States of America, she said, "Power must lie with the people, and we the people must use our power to fight for freedom, opportunity, fairness, and dignity of all. I will remain in that fight," the statement said. Harris would have entered a very crowded contest at this point already to replace term-limited California Governor Gavin Newsom as a front runner, given her widespread name recognition. Before serving and her popularity out here in California, before serving as a U.S. Senator and Vice President, she was also elected State Attorney General, District Attorney in San Francisco. So she's got a long track record of winning statewide elections here in California. The 2028 presidential contest, however, is expected also to attract a large field, which could potentially include Newsom himself, says AP. I add, oh, it will include Newsom himself. Her decision not to seek the governorship, however, keeps that contest to replace Newsom in 2026 wide open. The Democratic field already includes former U.S. Rep. Katie Porter, former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villagrosa, former Biden administration Health Secretary Javier Becerra, and a handful of state office holders, but not, as of today, Kamala Harris. All right. This week, Donald Trump's EPA chief, Lee Zeldin, made a major announcement that he was, in fact, moving ahead with a plan to reverse in one fell swoop every climate change regulation by the agency that has been enacted since the Obama administration, telling Fox News.
EPA is proposing to rescind the 2009 Obama EPA endangerment finding to eliminate all of the greenhouse gas emissions regulations that followed, including electric vehicle mandates, which amounts to $1 trillion worth of savings.
Okay, well, for a start, no matter how many times Trump and his sycophants repeat the phrase electric vehicle mandate, there is no electric vehicle mandate. Though, frankly, I would not mind if there was. And secondly, $1 trillion worth of savings by gutting climate regulations? Des, you reported, I think it was just last week on one of your Green News reports, the cost to the U.S. last year alone of climate change caused damage was above $1 trillion, not speculation, not funny math, not pretend EV mandates, but based on actual numbers of the costs to all of us of climate change, from intensified natural disasters, rising cost of homeowners insurance, as the insurance industry spreads the costs of increasing disasters to all of us.
Yeah, it was nearly $1 trillion last year, but that's still plenty.
Yep.
And it's mostly due to the rise in insurance premiums across the country and the cost of post-disaster rebuilding. Failure to act on climate change means we run through this consistent recurring cycle, disaster rebuild, disaster rebuild, disaster rebuild, and it's getting more expensive each time.
So you mean to say we won't save $1 trillion by doing away with regulations?
Correct. We won't save that money at all. That the Trump administration will be doing is setting up Americans to fail again and again and again.
Aha. But the fossil fuel industry, they may make an additional $1 trillion. And maybe that's what Zeldin is talking about. He was there on Fox News with his little buddy who joined him, Chris Wright, to help further hoax Fox News viewers. Chris Wright is a former fracking executive. He was tapped by Donald Trump to be the Secretary of the Energy Department. He was asked about what he saw as the goal of this effort to overturn all climate-related public safety regulations.
The goal is to restore confidence in science and data and rationalism. That's what enabled the creation of modern science. Then we slid back into sort of a cancel culture Orwellian squelching of science and talking about the science as opposed to the process that is science. We need to restore some common sense around climate change or energy, because the net result of what we've been doing is just impoverishing Americans, shipping jobs overseas, and doing pretty close to nothing on global greenhouse gas emissions.
Boy,
oh my God.
He's got all the buzzwords in there, doesn't he?
He does. It's like a Mad Libs of Fox News climate denier stuff.
Impoverishing Americans, shipping jobs overseas, and doing pretty much nothing on greenhouse global gas emissions. Now, on that last point, he's not necessarily wrong. It has been very difficult to curb the dangerous emissions caused by burning fossil fuels, though that is thanks in no small part to people like Chris Wright, the former CEO of Liberty Energy, a major fracking company who has literally captured the U.S. Energy Department by being tapped to run it. And, of course, to lie to the American people about energy. Chris Wright's claims that climate regulations are impoverishing Americans is absolutely absurd. In fact, Donald Trump's policies are now increasing the cost of energy to Americans. Shipping jobs overseas? Well, in fact, Joe Biden and the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act had resulted in a clean, renewable energy manufacturing boom in this country. Or at least it did until Trump and the Republicans began to unwind all of the tax incentives for those manufacturers to bring their factories here to the U.S., as they have been doing, bigly. And yep, we are certainly well down the rabbit hole when folks like Chris Wright and Lee Zeldin are undermining actual science by talking about actual science and scientists and decades of documentary evidence of climate change as being Orwellian, arguing that the act of undermining science is actually an act of, quote, common sense, and that real science is somehow Orwellian. Yes, it all is Orwellian indeed, but an explanation of what those two yutzes are actually talking about and some actual common sense on climate science and the legal fight to support it? Well, that is straight ahead with someone who has been in the trenches on this for decades now. NRDC's David Doniger joins us next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
By the way, that's the new Fox News theme song, I'm pretty sure. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As we discussed a bit on the program yesterday, as the story was still in the process of first breaking, the Trump administration's EPA on Tuesday officially announced what many scientists and environmentalists have long feared from the fossil fuel-friendly Republican administration. It is indeed making a direct assault on the official scientific finding underscoring virtually all of the nation's policies meant to combat and or mitigate our ever-worsening climate crisis. What unfolded on Tuesday is just the latest chapter, however, in a decades-long saga pitting industry profiteers against science and public safety. When Congress, under the Nixon administration, established the Environmental Protection Agency way back in 1970, it granted the agency broad authority to investigate and regulate pollutants through several foundational environmental laws, most notably the Clean Air Act and later the Clean Water Act. Yes, there was a time when even Republicans appeared to give a damn about pollution, the environment, and public safety. Crucially, at the time, Congress also included provisions for the EPA to update the list of pollutants to be regulated by the agency as scientific understanding evolved. It's built into the DNA of the EPA. Now, move the clock forward to 2003, and the EPA, then run by the very fossil fuel-friendly George W. Bush administration, made two determinations. First, they found that the EPA lacked authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases for climate change purposes. And second, they found even if the EPA did have the authority, it would still decline to set greenhouse gas emission standards for vehicles, one of the nation's largest sources of such emissions. Move the clock forward now to 2007. In a case brought by Massachusetts and 11 other states and several cities challenging the EPA's policy, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Massachusetts v. EPA affirmed that, yes, the EPA has the authority to regulate newly identified pollutants under the Clean Air Act, and that greenhouse gases largely caused by the unfettered burning of fossil fuels in fact qualified as air pollutants under the Act. The ruling said that the EPA must make a determination, a so-called endangerment finding, about whether greenhouse gas emissions pose an actual threat to human health and welfare. If the EPA finds that they do, then the agency, they said, was legally obligated, mandated, to regulate that threat under U.S. law. According to Patrick Parenteau, former director of Vermont Law School's Environmental Law Center, quote, the court emphasized that the endangerment finding was a scientific determination and rejected a laundry list of policy arguments made by the George W. Bush administration for why the government preferred to use non-regulatory approaches to reduce emissions. But the court said the only question was whether sufficient scientific evidence exists to determine whether greenhouse gases are harmful. The Bush EPA then completed a draft of something called an endangerment finding as mandated by the high court. However, the Bush White House literally refused to open that email from their own EPA containing that finding, managing to run out the clock through the end of its term. It was then left to the Obama EPA a few years later to complete and officially issue that endangerment finding in 2009, officially and scientifically determining that, yes, emissions from the burning of fossil fuels and other sources are in fact a danger to the health and safety of the public and therefore must be regulated under U.S. laws, including the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, just as the Supreme Court had made clear years earlier. Republicans, on behalf of the fossil fuel industry, meanwhile, and other industry polluters, have targeted that endangerment finding ever since. The Heritage Foundation, for example, has a right-wing manifesto you may have heard of called Project 2025. That manifesto explicitly calls for the repeal of the endangerment finding. If they could only unfind what the scientists had indeed found and documented thoroughly years earlier through years of study. Well, on Tuesday of this week, Trump EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin announced plans to unfind those findings by simply rescinding the scientific endangerment finding as a matter of policy, in what would appear to be the first step toward killing the EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions to combat dangerous human-caused climate change. Speaking at a truck dealership, naturally, in Indianapolis on Tuesday, Mr. Zeldin, the Trump-appointed head of the Environmental Protection Agency, denigrated climate science and argued that the agency did not have the authority to even issue the endangerment finding in 2009, just as the George W. Bush administration had done before it, even if that copy of the finding remained unread by the fossil fuel-friendly White House at the time. The Obama administration, argued Zeldin, has had no right to even issue the finding, much less the regulations to curb climate warming gases that were subsequently based on that finding. And that Zeldin's plan would amount to an unprecedented rollback of previously established regulations that were meant to protect the public and humanity itself.
Just to put some perspective of the magnitude of what we're here to announce today, if finalized, today's announcement would amount to the largest deregulatory action in the history of the United States.
So Somewhat tepid applaud there, I would say. Nonetheless, the draft policy announcement by Zeldin also argues, among other ridiculous things, that U.S. vehicle emissions are not significant in terms of overall global emissions of greenhouse gases, and that the costs to consumers in regulating those emissions outweigh the benefits to the public. I'll ask my guest about that in a moment. The New York Times calls the move, quote, President Trump's most consequential step yet to derail federal climate efforts and appears to represent a shift toward outright denial of the scientific consensus. Without the endangerment finding, the paper notes, the EPA would be left with no authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate the greenhouse gas emissions that are accumulating in the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels. It also marks a notable shift, they note, in the administration's position from one that had downplayed the threat of global warming to one that essentially flatly denies the overwhelming scientific evidence of climate change. And I would add, an administration apparently that's willing to go to court under an arguably much fossil fuel friendlier Supreme Court in order to make their case. It would not only reverse current regulations, but if the move is upheld in court, it could make it significantly harder for future administrations to rein in climate pollution from the burning of coal, oil, and gas, the Times notes. David Doniger, a longtime climate expert at the Natural Resources Defense Council, according to AP, accused Trump's Republican administration of using potential repeal of the endangerment finding, the legal foundation that currently underpins vital protections for millions of people from the severe threat of climate change, as a, quote, kill shot, unquote, that would allow the administration to make all climate regulations invalid. Quote, they're trying to completely defang the Clean Air Act by saying, well, this stuff's just not dangerous, Doniger told the Washington Post last week. That claim, he said, is just mind-bogglingly contrary to the evidence. Joining us now, I'm very happy to say, for more on the legal, political, scientific, and health consequences of this news, which frankly I don't think is yet being fully appreciated for the dangers that it poses to the public, is David Doniger, senior attorney and strategist for climate and energy at the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council, where he's been at the forefront of the battle against air pollution and global climate change since joining NRDC in 1978. Mr. Doniger helped formulate the 1987 Montreal Protocol, a successful one, the landmark international agreement designed to stop the depletion of the Earth's ozone layer. During the Bill Clinton administration, he served on the White House Council on Environmental Quality and at key posts at the EPA before rejoining the NRDC in 2001 to defend the Clean Air Act from continuing assaults in Congress and the White House. Mr. Doniger, it's an honor to have you here. Thank you for joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, first, as you know, you've been working in this area for decades, even as much of the endangerment finding saga was playing out, working its way through Congress, the courts, several presidential administrations. Did I generally hit the points in this long battle correctly in my intro there?
You did a very good job.
All right.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. Well, given that long history of documented science backing up the endangerment findings, on what basis is Trump's EPA chief here, Lee Zeldin, now justifying the proposal to overturn the agency's own scientific finding? He can't just declare that he wants to reverse it, right? He's got to have some sort of scientific basis for doing so.
Yeah, well, in order to take a regulation down, to tear it down, you have to go through the same kind of steps it took to justify a regulation in the first place. You have to have a proposal. It has to have solid backing. Then you have to take public comment and analyze the comments that come in from scientists, from environmental groups, from businesses, from everybody. You have to have a final decision that makes a rational explanation that connects to the law.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fail, then you're subject to, we'll take you to court. Now, this is the first step yesterday is the proposal, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. Basically, they have thrown a lot of spaghetti at the wall, and they want to see if any of it sticks. Much of the spaghetti is all tangled up around itself. So it's going to take some work to show all the different ways in which this is just plainly wrong and illegal. But we will do that in the coming months, and we'll take them to court if they persist.
The New York Times reports that the Trump EPA is citing a report that the Energy Department commissioned from five scientists who are known for their rejection of the overwhelming scientific consensus on climate change, namely that it is being driven by the burning of fossil fuels. I mean, a single report like that from five known climate deniers, that would not be enough to overshadow, to essentially reverse decades of climate science from literally tens of thousands of scientific reports here, correct?
I think that's right. I think that's very right. And you're going to hear in the comment period from a lot of the scientists who are part of that mainstream that has put together our understanding of how these pollutants heat the world up and what the dangers are from that overheating. And when you're done, when the comments are in, the record is going to be set straight, and these fringe people, how fringe their views are, will be clear. It's disheartening, though, that the energy secretary and the head of the EPA cherry pick five known fringe climate deniers and position their report as though it refutes the mountain of evidence that this is a real problem. It's just, they're in an echo chamber with themselves and trying to construct an alternative reality.
You are quoted, David Doniger, by AP this week as describing what the EPA is doing here as a, quote, kill shot that would essentially allow the administration to invalidate pretty much all climate regulations in one fell swoop. Am I understanding that correctly?
That is their goal. The way the Clean Air Act works, most of the provisions to regulate pollution are triggered by a finding that this pollution is dangerous and that the vehicles or the power plants or whatever contribute to that pollution. If they can somehow turn reality upside down and conclude that it's not dangerous, then they think they will have knocked the legs out from under all of these regulations.
Yeah, I mean, they're talking about, every climate regulation will fall if they can unfind this finding. How many laws and climate regulations were actually enacted in response to that endangerment finding that could soon be at risk? Are we talking about a handful, dozens, hundreds?
Well, I'll just point to the most important ones. Vehicles, cars and trucks together. Are the number one source of climate pollution from the United States. And power plants are the second largest. There's also the third largest is leakage of methane from the oil and gas exploration and production and delivery system. And there are standards that EPA has set for those three industries. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude, if the U.S. transportation sector was a country all by itself, it would be the fourth largest emitter in the world.
Wow.
If the power plants in the U.S. were a country by themselves, they'd be the fifth largest. if the United States were to abandon the effort to clean up its power plants and its vehicles, those were together account for about 2/3 of the American carbon pollution. We would just be walking away from this horrible problem, leaving literally billions of people to suffer. It's just dreadfully out of touch with the science and dreadfully irresponsible on any moral plane.
The New York Times reports that reversing the endangerment finding, quote, would not only reverse current regulations, but if upheld by the court, it would make it significantly harder for future administrations to rein in climate pollution from the burning of coal, oil, and gas. How would such a finding by this administration handcuff future administrations?
Well, that kind of depends on which of these spaghetti strands they choose.
Okay.
And whether the whether their action is upheld by the courts. So the first thing is, you know, if basically they just said we have a different view of the science, then the next administration could say, well, we're going back to the original view of the science. And presumably they would have the ability to reestablish the consensus finding or return us to reality. If, on the other hand, they say, well, despite the fact that the Clean Air Act, despite the fact that the Supreme Court held in 2007 that greenhouse gases are air pollutants under the Clean Air Act, and that EPA has the authority and responsibility to reduce them if they're dangerous. Despite all that, if the EPA concludes, well, they got the EPA in 2009 and the Supreme Court in 2007 got the law wrong. No, the Clean Air Act is not triggered, even if this stuff is dangerous. If they were to make that finding and it were to be upheld by the courts, then that would sort of permanently damage the Clean Air Act as a law to deal with climate change. Now, I think that's where they're headed, but I don't think that that's going to hold up in court, even in the Supreme Court.
Even in this Supreme Court, which has...
Yeah, well, let me say something about that. So there is that decision in 2007, and people often say, well, the composition of the court has changed dramatically since then.
Right.
That's true. But there are also three other Supreme Court climate change decisions since the 2007 Massachusetts decision. One in 2011, one in 2014, and one in 2022. And all three of those decisions... except the premise that EPA, that the Clean Air Act gives EPA the responsibility and the authority to curb this, that greenhouse gases are air pollutants. Add to that that the Congress in 2022, in part of the Inflation Reduction Act, wrote into the Clean Air Act that the greenhouse gases are air pollutants. It's now in the statute. It's very hard to see how this "oh, never mind" approach from the current administration would stand up even in today's Supreme Court. Because look, take that 2022 decision. It held that EPA's power plant regulations it struck them down, but not because EPA lacked the power to regulate carbon pollution. What the Supreme Court said, you didn't do it the right way. You didn't write the right kind of regulation. You can do it this way. You can't do it that way. So the Biden administration followed the Supreme Court's decision in 2024, issuing standards that follow the path that the Supreme Court said was, in fact, in EPA's authority. So it's, you know, the court, you never can be sure with this court, but it's not like we're just dependent on a decision from 2007. We've got four decisions that go right through 2022, and where the present court issued that last one.
I'm going to embrace your optimism on that. I certainly hope you're right. But, you know, I fear that this court and this administration, the Republicans of Congress, are going to do anything they can, obviously, to challenge recent precedent in this case, because we've seen them do that before. I've got a couple of other points I want to ask you, David Doniger, about this effort. The EPA chief, Lee Zeldin, sort of echoing the late Rush Limbaugh, announced that he was taking on, quote, the holy grail of the climate change religion, unquote, and that climate regulations will, quote, bankrupt the country. And that what the EPA is doing is simply, quote, its part in ushering in the golden age of American success. He basically was saying that, oh, these regulations, they're just too costly. They are killing us. And that, you know, the cost to consumers of regulating greenhouse gas emissions basically outweigh the benefits there. But first, I don't believe that's true, but does the economy factor into the EPA's mandate to protect public health at all?
Let me start with the, you know, I'm kind of offended by the assertion that this is a religion.
Right.
We're following the science. We're following common sense. We're following what millions of Americans can see happening to them. You know, in 2009, it all seemed still like it might be in the distant future. But in 2025, it's here and now.
Yeah.
135 people got killed in the floods in Texas. 35 people got killed in the fires in L.A. in January. Mm-hmm. I could go on and on. Millions of people are sweltering in the eastern half of the country now under the heat dome. And some of those people are going to die. Mm-hmm. And this is not religion. This is fact.
Yep.
So that's the first thing. Second, Administrator Zeldin and his overlords in the White House are trying a pretty blatant trick. They're saying, we want to do a cost-benefit analysis, but we're erasing all the benefits.
Right.
You can't consider as having any value at all reduction of greenhouse gases. You have to put it in as a big zero. And then, you know, if you do this cost-benefit analysis right, you find that, yes, it might cost over the next 45 years, it might cost people more for their cars, mm-hmm. A little bit. Although even now, the electric cars and the cleaner gasoline cars are almost at parity in their purchase price. Mm-hmm. But more important than that is that when you own one of these cars, you save $6,000 over the life of the car in reduced costs of filling it up with gas, mm-hmm. and reduced costs of maintenance, because the modern cars don't break down the way the current ones tend to, mm-hmm. and so when you put the costs and benefits up there, even ignoring the climate benefits, just the out-of-pocket cost to buy the car, fuel it, and maintain it, the cleaner cars save the customer $6,000 over the life of the car. And in Zeldin's announcement yesterday, he just wipes out those savings.
Right.
And he wipes out all the benefits. You know, human lives and illnesses and so on, you can, it's kind of crass, but you can put a dollar value on the benefit of saving my life or your life. Mm-hmm. And that adds up. It adds up to hundreds of billions of dollars in benefits that are just treated as a big fat zero.
Decreased costs for treating asthma in children, decreased costs and, of insurance and so forth.
And the value of being alive, you know?
Yeah.
But who benefits from this? Well, it's not actually even the car companies. The car companies are left now in some uncertainty. Should I go with the flow and roll back my standards, you know, that I make these cars to, and take the risk that this gets reversed in the courts? Or should I stay with the plan and keep improving the emissions performance of the vehicles because I don't want to be caught short if this is reversed. Anyway, it's maximum uncertainty for the companies. The ones who are looking to win are the oil companies that get to sell you more gas. That's $6,000 that the car owner saves is mostly from not having to put as much gas into the car.
Yep.
In the case of an electric car, none. In case of a high-efficiency, clean, gasoline-powered car, much less gas. So it's the oil companies who fear the transition to clean vehicles even more than the car companies do.
Yeah, and I don't have any sense, maybe you do, I don't have any sense that the car companies are necessarily looking back. They're seeing the future. They're seeing where this is moving, no matter what the U.S. does, correct?
The car companies are, first of all, they're worried as heck about losing the race for the global car market to the Chinese, who are making electric cars out the wazoo.
Right.
And can sell them in not just in China, but in most other markets. And the American companies are getting out-competed. That's why they supported the incentives for building battery plants and transitioning to electrics in the Inflation Reduction Act. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're actually hurt by the recently passed big, beautiful, ugly bill.
Yeah.
And so they're being hurt in that kind of international competition. They thought the Biden standards were going too far too fast. Well, we can disagree about that. They want the Trump administration to weaken those standards some, but they don't want them erased. Mm-hmm. And that's where the Trump administration is going. That's not what the automakers want.
Correct. And yet, yeah, they also, the Trump administration pretending there is an EV mandate. There has never been a mandate. But when you, piece by piece say that we need to decrease emissions and so forth, moving forward with electric cars just makes sense. There is no mandate on China to do that, but they are taking it upon themselves to do it because it makes sense. David Doniger, the three former EPA leaders criticized Zeldin, saying that this proposal would endanger the lives of millions of Americans. Christy Todd Whitman, who led the EPA under Republican President George W. Bush, said, quote, "If there is an endangerment finding to be found anywhere, it should be found on this administration because what they're doing is so contrary to what the Environmental Protection Agency is about." I would love your response to her thoughts there, but also a word or two, if you could, as someone who has been in this fight now for decades, as I noted, about how it is that the environment, which, again, the EPA was founded under Richard Nixon, how it can be that it has gone from being a notably bipartisan issue in many aspects to becoming perhaps the most partisan of issues of all, I guess, maybe along with gun regulations. What happened? You've been there the whole time. What happened here to make this so different these many years later?
I think that our environmental policies and climate policies are a sort of collateral damage in a larger cultural war. People elected Donald Trump, but if you poll the American public on do they think carbon dioxide is an air pollutant, strong majorities, including among Republicans, say yes. And should it be controlled? Yes. So there is no mandate from the public in the recent election to be dismantling environmental protections or climate protections in particular. The American people increasingly understand how this threatens their health and they want action. But, like so many other issues, this administration serves special interests who put a lot of money into the campaign. And while their story is they want to make life more affordable for Americans and so on and so on, I don't see it happening. And I don't think the American people see it happening, whether it's grocery prices or, tariffs or so many other things, people are understanding that, beginning to understand that the results are the opposite of the rhetoric.
Seems to me that it's going to have to be Republican voters giving the corrective to their own party somehow, which might be a tall ask, but we'll find out.
Well, I mean, and, you know, let me put it this way. The outcome of national elections is determined by, you know, 10% of people in the middle. Mm-hmm. Mostly you call themselves independents. So I long for the return among hardcore Republicans of an appreciation for public health and environmental protection. I long for that. We may not need it if the independents get the message.
Mm, I gotcha. All right, finally, how can and will this new determination, because I think they're going to make it no matter what the public comments have to say about it. I think they're dead set on making this determination one way or another. But how can that determination be fought? I know that the NRDC, your organization, plans to challenge this matter legally if need be. But what does that look like? Is it a regulation by regulation matter? Can the unfinding of the endangerment finding itself be challenged in court? What should we expect to see on the legal front in the days and months ahead now?
Yeah, so yes, the challenge will be, if they erase the endangerment finding, we will bring a lawsuit to challenge that. If they erase the vehicle standards in the same action or separately, we will challenge that. Same with the power plant standards. So there may be multiple suits. Now, one of the unusual features of the Clean Air Act is that all these suits have to be brought in one place, which is in the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. So, you know, this won't be playing out in the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans or the Eighth Circuit, you know, or the Ninth Circuit. It'll mm-hmm. be playing out in one court, and they'll make the decisions. And then the only other court that will look at this potentially is the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And so the Court of Appeals, let me put it this way. If the EPA makes its decisions by the end of the year, the lawsuits in the Court of Appeals will start then. They'll probably take about a year to get the decision from that court. And then there would be some months before, you know, assuming the losers appeal to the Supreme Court, there'd be some months before it would come up before the Supreme Court, maybe even another whole other year. Mm-hmm. So this, sadly, this legal battle will probably take most of the Trump administration to unfold, and that's all lost time from the point of view of trying to stave off the worst impacts of climate change. But it's the path we'll follow, and we think we can hold them to what the to follow the law. As I said, there are four Supreme Court decisions, including as recent as 2022. Mm-hmm. That follow the premise that follow the conclusion, the holding of the Massachusetts case that mm-hmm. Congress gave EPA the authority and responsibility to address any form of dangerous air pollution, including the greenhouse gases. And this administration's swinging for the fences, but most of the time when you swing for the fences, you strike out.
I hope you're right. In the meantime, the regulations that are in place, even while they're fighting the overall premise for those regulations remain in place, and the NRDC and other groups can also go to court to force the administration to enforce those regulations in the meantime, correct?
Well, yeah, there are some things that we can do. Frankly, it's hard to make an administration enforce the law if they don't want to. But we're gonna challenge every step backwards and try to push them forwards where we can.
Go get them, sir. David Doniger is a senior attorney and strategist for climate and energy at the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council. You can find and support their work at nrdc.org. And you can find David Doniger on the Blue Skies, where he is simply David Doniger. Mr. Doniger, greatly appreciate you joining us today, sir. Good luck in the months ahead. I think you're going to have a battle on your hands.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the chance to talk to people about it.
You bet. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's just so much. He has been through decades of this fight in the trenches, as you've said, mm-hmm. and fighting the same people over and over and over again just to get the progress that we've managed to get so far.
And I will say, that his comments earlier about the Supreme Court,
yeah,
and that he doesn't think it'll be quite as easy as some of us may think, certainly I thought, for them to hand the Trump administration a win on this one, mm-hmm. that they would have to toss out years of climate science and regulations in one fell swoop, but that there are a number of precedents that recent precedents from this court
right.
that would prevent them from doing so. I really hope he's right about that. I don't know. He knows this stuff way better than I do. But his optimism there on that point was somewhat reassuring.
Yeah.
I gotta say.
Well, let's be clear. Worlds turn on this. The future of the planet will turn in part on how this particular court fight plays out.
Oh, do you think John Roberts' court cares about that?
I don't think he does. I mean, as David Doniger mentioned, that he thinks that environment and climate rules are part of collateral damage in the culture wars, mm-hmm. and we are all part of that collateral damage from the culture wars with the fossil fuel industry profiteering off of freely polluting the air and the water and freely getting the opportunity to make money mm-hmm. off of making climate change as horrific as possible for all future generations. So this is a fight that will obviously continue to go on, but it has very serious, very long-term consequences.
Well, it does, and of course it feels to me like the Supreme Court is teeing up to give Donald Trump whatever they want on this. So the fact that David Doniger, of all people, says, don't be so sure
right.
that there's a lot of recent precedent that may make them reject what the Trump administration is doing here if it gets as far as them, as I suspect it will. That was good to hear. I didn't expect him to make that argument, but I'm really happy that he did.
Yes.
And I will be even happier if he turns out to be right about that. So for now, I'm going to go with what David Doniger says, that the chances are not quite as terrible in the at the Supreme Court as I might have characterized them.
Works for me.
We'll take what we can get, yes. where we can get it. All right, thanks again to David Doniger of nrdc.org. Thanks to my producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always an honor. It's always appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. We can only do what we do every day here thanks to those of you who hit the donate button when you stop by Bradblog or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves, covering stuff and in ways that you just don't really hear anywhere else, certainly in the corporate mainstream media. So thank you for that in advance. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at the Brad Blog. See you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.